Welcome to Gateway's podcast. We hope God speaks to you through this message from our guest speaker. For more information about Gateway, please visit www.gatewaybc.com.
But Don and I have been friends back since seminary over 30 years ago, and so grateful for Mary and Don, how God's used them here. I've heard so much about you throughout the years, and it's just a blessing to be here. My name is Kevin. I'm the president of the North American Mission Board, and say, what is that? You're part of a family, a network of churches that plants 1,200. Our goal is to plant 1,200 churches a year. So you can do the math real quick. That's about 100 a month. That's every Sunday you come to worship. We're launching roughly 20 to 25 churches every Sunday, somewhere in North America, from New York to New Mexico, from California to Florida, we're planting churches. And I just want to say thank you for how you planted one in Toronto and now going to do one in Portland. And so we'll talk more about that as we go through. We're going to be in Mark chapter 2, if you'd like to begin to turn there. And before I do that, though, if it's okay, just so I know how it is when you have a new guy, you're trying to figure out, you look on your phone for some kind of game to play or do something until the real guy gets here next week. But I want to let you know a little bit about me, and then we'll transition right into Mark chapter 2, introduce my family just real fast. I wasn't able to bring them with me, but I brought a picture, okay? I have six kids and actually six grandchildren. This picture was taken two youngest grandchildren were born in the last month, so we've not had a picture, another one taken. But my wife, I've been married for 33 years, Lynette, to the right there. But we have six kids, as I said. Our two oldest daughters are in the middle. Those are their husbands. You don't need to really know them. And I always tell them, you're an it until further notified, you know. And then our oldest son is in the top right. He's a senior in college out in California, in Riverside, California, at California Baptist. Then God bless us with a whole second phase of children, if you will. Our youngest three children were all adopted, and we're so grateful for that. Libby is in the back right. She's from China. They found Libby in a shoebox outside of a police station, and we adopted her when she's one. She's from China, and she's now 17. And so she's really an angel on this earth. She's a sweetheart. And then the second child we adopted was Micah Lynn. She's in the far left in the middle there from Ethiopia. We adopted Micah Lynn when she's three, and she's now 14. And her spiritual gift is bossiness, all right? She's just very bossy. She'll put her hand on her hip and let you know exactly how it is. We moved to Alpharetta. Well, that's where I live now, Alpharetta, Georgia. She went into our neighbor's house and put her hand on her hip and says, "You people have issues." And they're like, "Do what?" And she said, "Your house is a mess. You have issues." And we had to sit her down and say, "Look, sweetheart, we're trying to make friends and you're not helping, all right?" So she keeps us all in line. And then the final child we adopted with JM, he's in the back left. And JM was 12 when we adopted him, and he's now 19. He's a freshman in college, and he's from the Philippines. And it's interesting, when people see our family, they're like six kids from four different countries. You know, like, how did that happen? And I often say, I'm just very competitive. And no, what I mean is six kids from four different countries. When we watch the Olympics, we win. All right? We do. JM, when we went to pick up JM in the Philippines, there was something pretty interesting. They said, now be very careful with him when you take him back to the hotel, because they found JM wandering the streets when he was around five or six and asleep in the back of a pickup truck. They took him to the orphanage, and he was there from five until we adopted him at 12. And so they said, he's not used to some of the same luxuries that you're used to. And I'm like, luxuries? What, like, you guys confused. What type of luxuries are you talking about? And he said, like hot water. He's not used to hot water, but they basically take sink baths there. I know he was in Manila. There is hot water in Manila, but not in this orphanage. And so he said, just be real careful. He'd harm himself. Just make sure he understands the whole dynamic. So we go back to the hotel, and you can imagine your first night in a hotel. And now I'm letting him bounce on the beds. I'm letting him do those things you do your first night ever in a hotel. And then it comes time for bath time, and I say, hey, JM, come here, buddy. I want to show you something. So we go in the bathroom. I turn the water on lukewarm, and then I say, hey, let me have your hand. So I took his hand, and I put his hand underneath the water, being lukewarm, and then I just gradually turned the water warmer and warmer and warmer until he began to feel hot water for the very first time. And he said, "That is wonderful." I said, "It is wonderful. You're going to love it. Now, I'm going to go in there, and you take off your clothes and jump in the shower." And he said, "Shower? What's a shower?" Well, I wasn't thinking. You know, they had taught him English, and still it was broken, but they had taught it to him. But some things did not translate because, well, he'd never been in a shower. He didn't have a shower. So I had to explain a shower to him. Have you ever explained a shower to somebody? I mean, it's not that easy. You know, it's like, it's like water from heaven, son. All right, look, you're going to like it. Just trust me. There's some of those things you just don't think about when you adopt. It's like the first time we went out to eat with JM being 12. He'd never done that before, gone to a restaurant like that. So I had to order for him. And I said, "Just bring him some chicken fingers." He's like, "No, I not eat chicken fingers. I said, "No, son, they're not chicken fingers. That's just what they call them." He said, "Well, why do they call them that?" And I was like, "I don't know exactly. Just dip them in barbecue sauce. It'll be fine." You can only imagine the first time we had buffalo wings. You know, I mean, there's just constant explanation at our house about absolutely everything. But I'll never forget, though. He went in and took that shower, and 45 minutes later, he comes out all shriveled up, smelling good, but loving hot water. And, you know, today he's 19 still. When he's home from college, taking a shower, he's singing and loving it. You know what? Even 7 years later, he's not forgotten what it's like not to have hot water. He appreciates hot water. And I remember thinking that night when I put him to bed, I thought, you know, how many kids 12 years old appreciate hot water? They just don't. We take so many things for granted. Hey, son, what's your name? Patrick. All right. Patrick, how old are you? 15. There you go. Wasn't a trick question, I promise. All right. All right. Patrick, let me ask you. All right. I picked you, Patrick, because you're like the cleanest one in this section. All right. So, Patrick, tell me, the last time you had a shower in the last 2 or 3 days? Yeah? Okay, good. We're all thankful. All right, Patrick, when you took a shower and you felt that hot water, did you go like, "Yes, hot water"? Did you do that? You didn't do that. You see, that's what I thought, Patrick. You see? See, folks, Patrick is what's wrong with America. All right? I'm messing with you, sort of. You see, the problem is, Patrick, none of us did that. All right, well, none of us think of that. We get used to certain things. You get so used to certain things, you take them for granted. You just don't think twice about it. You're not thinking about if you're going to eat lunch. You just, well, what is you're going to have for lunch? We just take certain things for, you're sitting on padded pews. You take those for granted, but not everybody has that. It's not like it is here everywhere. That's what my point is, all right? We get so used to certain things, and even to churches. Sometimes you get used to churches. When I say, "Hey, we're going to plant 1,200 churches a year," and you say, "Well, is there really a need for that many more churches? I can drive down to, you know, just 2 miles from here and drive through so many different churches. Is there really a need?" Well, you're thinking that it's all everywhere is like it is here, and it's just not. Let me give you an example of what I mean and why we need to plant churches where you're planting churches. Did you know Mississippi is the most churched state in all of North America? There are more churches in Mississippi than anywhere else in North America per capita. There's one Southern Baptist church for every 1,394 people in Mississippi. Missiologists say that you need one church for every 2,000 people if you're really going to reach an area, okay? You say, "Well, what's it like in South Carolina?" I knew you'd ask. And so in South Carolina, there's one for every 2,287 people, all right? So there's a lot of churches. You have a lot of churches and a lot of opportunity to reach South Carolina. But look, when you go to places like, say, New York, there's one for every 51,000 people. And where you just planted a church in Toronto, when you go to Canada, there's one for every 94,000 people. There are areas in Canada where you can drive for 3 hours and not drive by another evangelical church. So that is why there is an incredible need to plant churches. In evangelical churches, the majority of evangelical churches are in the South. I like to tell folks, the majority of evangelical churches are in the SEC and the ACC. It's the other conferences that are going to hell, and we have got to reach them, all right? And that's why we're planting churches in the Northeast, the Midwest, the West, and Canada. We can't just loop around where we are and just take care of ourselves. And that's why S-E-N-D is so important, to send. Not just send our resources, but send ourselves there. Hey, it may not be that you need to quit your job and go there. It may be you go on a short-term mission trip. Maybe you're a college senior, and as you look to get a job somewhere, you can say, you know, I'm going to go to, and be very intentional after graduation, go to a specific city and be a part of a church plant for, say, 2 years. We encourage every college student to graduate and go 2 years to serve somewhere, find a job in that community, be an engineer, but be one in Pittsburgh or Philadelphia or Portland or Toronto, and see a different part of North America, but invest yourself intentionally somewhere for 2 years and see what God could do. You never know. But it's all a part of being sent. Well, that's what we're going to look at today, because look, as we focus on missions, so often you look around at the different displays and you're going to have the opportunity to connect with missionaries. We often think of missions as out there. But I want you to see today, every one of you, God has called every one of us to be on mission. If you're a believer today, if you have a relationship with Christ, you are to be on mission. You are to be on mission. You don't retire from that opportunity. You're not too young for that opportunity. If you're a believer today, you are to be on mission. Now, I want to read a passage. You perhaps have heard it before in Mark chapter 2. All right? I want to read through the story, then I'd like to just go back and walk ourselves through it. Okay? I love the book of Mark, and it's something you need to understand as we begin to read Mark. It's one of the four Gospels, but I am convinced that Mark had an attention disorder, all right? Now, if you read the Gospel of Mark, he'll go for 5 or 6 verses, sometimes 10, and boom, he changes the subject. And then he'll go for another 5 or 10 verses, and boom, I mean, completely changes the subject. If you want details, you've got to go to Matthew or John or our Gospel of Luke, but not Mark. Mark, he just does, you know, he skims. If you're like throwing a rock, he kind of skims the general things. My wife gets so frustrated with me because I'm that way. She'll say, hey, did so-and-so have a baby? And I was like, yeah, they did. They had a baby. A boy or girl? It's a baby. All right, it's a baby. I don't know how much it weighed. I don't know boy or girl. I don't know the name, but it was a baby. All right. And that's the idea. Mark just does general things. And that's why as he tells his story, there's some gaps in there purposely. He left those, but the other gospels often fill those in. But some things obviously happen. So let's go through and read, if you will. And just remember, as Mark tells his story, he's flying through it, you know, from a 30,000. He's a 30,000 foot guy, we'll say. And let's just read as we begin in Mark chapter 2, verse 1. When Jesus returned to Capernaum several days later, the news spread quickly that he was back home. Soon the house where he was staying was so packed with visitors that there was no more room, not even outside the door. While he was preaching God's word to them, 4 men arrived carrying a paralyzed man on a mat. They couldn't bring him to Jesus because of the crowd, so they dug a hole through the roof above his head. Then they lowered the man on his mat right down in front of Jesus. Seeing their faith, remember that part, Jesus, seeing their faith, said to the paralyzed man, "My child, your sins are forgiven." But some of the teachers of the religious law were sitting there and thought to themselves, "What is he saying? This is blasphemy. Only God can forgive sins." Jesus knew immediately what they were thinking, so they asked him, "Why do you question this in your hearts? It is easier to say to the paralyzed man, 'Son, your sins are forgiven,' or say, 'Stand up, pick up your mat, and walk.' So I will prove to you that the Son of Man has the authority on earth to forgive sins." Then Jesus turned to the paralyzed man and said, "Stand up, pick up your mat, and go home." And the man jumped up, grabbed his mat, and walked out through the stunned onlookers. And actually, as they said that, they said, we've never seen anything like this before. Well, let's rewind and just walk ourselves through the story. All right? Mark says they had gathered in a place and the church was packed. The house was packed. There was overflow, was overflowing. There was no more room for anyone. But meanwhile, on the other side of town, it says, here comes a paralytic brought by four men, but something had to happen before that. So on the other side of town, there's at least one guy. At least one guy had an idea of, hey, I heard Jesus is in town. I know what Jesus has done in other cities. And look, I'm convinced if we get our friend, I'm sure he called him by name. If we get our friend and get him to Jesus, Jesus can heal him and change his life forever. But I'm going to need some help. Look, would you help me? Yeah. Will you help me? You help me? They came up with a plan to meet at a certain time, to meet at a certain place. And they went by his house, obviously. They picked him up and carried him to where Jesus was. All right? So here they come. Now, this is where Mark allows them to enter the story. And he says, there came four men carrying a paralytic and bringing him to Jesus. They get there. And then what happens? I love it because Mark, again, at 30,000 feet, says they get there. The place is packed. So they put him on the roof. They dig a hole in the roof and they lower him to Jesus and Jesus heals him. Well, I was getting a kick out of that because Mark acts like this happens every Sunday. All right. He got song, special music, dig hole in roof, lower. No. Back. It doesn't happen every Sunday. Let's slow it down a little bit, and what do you think happened? Something had to happen. They got there, the place was packed. I'm sure they had a little huddle, like, hey, fellas, what do you think? What should we do? What should we do? They huddled up. Did you know psychologists say that one out of every four people tend to be negative? Did you know that? One out of it, don't point. Please don't point. But you know, one out of every four people tend to be negative. They tend to be kind of like an Eeyore, like it's going to rain. You know, they just round down. Well, I'm sure one of these four probably was somewhat negative. Like, I knew this wasn't a good idea, or we should have come to the third service. You know what I mean? You can only imagine some of the dialogue that was going on. But we do know at least one guy had an idea. At least one guy says, now listen, fellas, I got an idea. Now here's what we're going to do. What we're going to do is we're going to take him and put him on the roof. I can't help but think that the paralytic at that moment kind of propped himself up and was like, do what? Are you kidding me? No, now settle. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to put you on the roof. We're going to kind of guess where we think Jesus is. And then we're going to dig a big hole, and we're going to lower you down to Jesus, and Jesus is going to heal you. I'm sure one of those guys probably says, but we've never done it that way here before. Or it's not in the bulletin. You know, I mean, you can imagine some of the responses that you get. But that's exactly what they did. They put him on the roof. And again, can you imagine? I mean, next Sunday, Brother Don preaching, and midway through his sermon, a sudden some dust begins to fall, and some more dust begins to fall, and all of a sudden you look up and there's a hand coming through the roof, another hand through the roof, and then a hole appears, a bigger hole appears. You know, people start talking. I bet it's the students. You know, it's probably the youth ministry. You know, we always blame everything on the youth ministry. You can imagine, all of a sudden a hole appears, and then four heads all look down, you know. It's like, lower him down, Cletus. And they lower him down. And can you imagine that taking place? I don't care how good of a speaker is. If that's happening, I'm watching it. All right? I have attention disorders, I said, but we all have that to some degree. We really do. It's amazing. I'm preaching a lot of different facilities. Anytime a baby starts crying, it's hilarious. You can have 1,000 people in a building and a baby cries. Everybody stops and watches the baby leave, you know. It's like, it's a baby. Or you ever been in a room where it starts pouring down rain? It's really funny from up here. When it's pouring down rain, everybody looks up like, it's like, Like it's rain. It's happened before. We're easily distracted. So if that happens, you're watching it. So they lower him down. And remember what I told you to pay attention to? Mark said, Jesus, seeing their faith, decided to heal him. So Mark's implying, look, when Jesus saw their faith, he saw the effort of these four, their faith. He said, look, I'm going to do something remarkable here to show them who I really am and who I have the authority over. Because of their faith, I'm going to do this. And that's why he told, and you know, it's amazing. Jesus heals the guy, and then what happens? Something incredible happens. He heals the guy, and people get ticked. And it's the religious guys are sitting there with their arms folded. Like, who does he think he is? I mean, who does he think he is? And Jesus had the ability of knowing what they were thinking. And he goes, Personally, I don't want to know what you're thinking right now. You know, like, boy, I wish Brother Don was here. When's this got to come and be done? I want to hear those thoughts, you know. Jesus knew what they were thinking. He says, look, why do you reason those things in your heart? And he says, what you need to understand is I have the authority on earth to forgive sins. And what he was trying to help them understand is, look, that's far more important. I have the authority to forgive your sins. I'm going to heal this guy physically. But that's temporary. You see, think about it. He heals the paralytic, but the paralytic eventually does die. Okay? And things physical are temporary. What he's saying is, what I have is spiritual. It's forever and ever. I can forgive sins, and that's far greater. I love the conversation he has with the paralytic, because everything just stops because these people are complaining. And basically Jesus says, look, don't mind those guys. Don't mind them. You pick up your mat and you go on home. And that's it. Mark moves on. Now, what I think is amazing about, think about that. He just goes on. Have you ever thought about what happened when they got home? He took his mat and just went home. You think he just walked in and says, hey, what's for supper? No, they carried him out of there. Now he's walking back in. Man, I'd love to know what happened when he went back in the house. I mean, the celebration, you know there were some questions. Like, what happened? What happened to you? Can you only imagine how he tried to explain that? I've thought about it. I think the best explanation perhaps comes from the blind man when the blind man said, look, all I know is I once was blind, but now I see. And Jesus is the one that made the difference. That's the only explanation possible. Now, I want you to notice something important here. Did you catch the name of the four guys? Did you catch their names? All right. Now, they're just not in there. It's not in the Bible. And the thing I want you to remember, you don't need to know their names as much as we just need to understand their passion of their heart. It's very obvious. I love these guys. Their passion of their heart was whatever it takes. Whatever it takes. Look, if you're a football coach, you want these guys on your team. If you own a business, you want these guys working for you. Why? Because think about it. Now, here they are. They have compassion for a friend. They all go intentionally out of their way, go and pick him up. It's a lot of trouble to do that. And then they take him to where Jesus is. And then when they get there, I love the fact that, look, the place is packed. They can't get in, but they are not deterred. No, we came here to get him to Jesus. And we're not going to come back the next time. We're not going to wait till the next service. No, no, no. We're going to get him to Jesus. So what's the best way to do that? Well, let's go up to the roof and dig a hole. Man, I love that. They called an audible. They were going to do whatever it took, whatever it takes to get him to Jesus. Look, to be on mission, that's what it means. To be so intent on doing whatever it takes to do what? To get their friend to Jesus. I want to ask you that specifically. Who is it right now in your life, who's your one? Who's the one person that you're praying for right now that does not know Christ? Who's the one neighbor or one coworker, one person in school with? Who's the one? Who's your one? You're a believer. We're called to make disciples. That's not a suggestion. It's an expectation to make disciples. Who's your one? If you read first part of John, you know, Andrew went and got Peter. That was his one. He said, come and see. He had no idea at the time how God was going to use Peter. An incredible ministry that Peter had, because Andrew cared enough to get Peter to Jesus. My point is, who is your one? We're all called to be obedient. Missions, be very careful as you celebrate missions. You don't celebrate something that's out there. It's in another country. It's in another state. We give money and we pay guys to go do that. No, you see, missions is about you being sent. Not necessarily to another country. Not necessarily to another state. It may be simply next door. Who's your one? Say, my one, it's a guy named Chris. It's my neighbor. I just want to encourage you today as we make commitments in just a moment about missions. I really want you to think about who is your one. You say, well, I don't have one. Well, then today is a great day to bow your head and say, God, show me somebody in my life that does not know you that can be my one. So I just don't know anyone. Well, then shame on you. You remember, Jesus very intentionally ate and connected with people who were not believers. So much so the religious people are like, who is he thinking? What's he doing? He's connecting with people outside the family. He's like, you know, I came to seek and save those who were lost. And he intentionally did that. Told you about J.M. After he took that shower, it was time to go to bed. And you can imagine, he's 12. Our first night together as a family, and we're in Manila. So I tuck him in, and I'll never forget, he hugged me really, really tight. He's still to this day a very tight hugger. And said, love you, Dad. I said, love you too, buddy. Then he did something that was kind of awkward at first. I didn't understand it, but he took his hands and he pushed in on my cheeks like this, really tight. And it was awkward because he didn't say anything. He just pushed in. And I'm thinking, man, I should have listened during orientation, you know? Like, is this a Filipino custom, you know? Am I supposed to do it back to him? You know, I was just at loss. And he pushed in a little harder, and big brown Filipino eyes. And I said, hey, buddy, what's up? What's wrong? Then he said something that I will never, ever forget. The big brown eyes said, I will be a good son for you. Oh, man, melted my heart. I said, well, I'll be a good dad for you. I promise. Now, you going to bed? He said, yes, sir. Next morning, 4 a.m, his face was right here. 4 a.m. Morning, Dad. I went, whoa. Morning. He said, I'll be a good son for you today. I was like, well, good. Why don't you go on back to bed? You say 4. You know what's interesting? Now, all of our kids were very disciplined when we adopt them. They'd get up at 4, and they would do chores from 4 to 5, breakfast from 5 to 5:30, and they'd go to school at 6. I mean, it's incredible how disciplined they are. Patrick, what time did you get up this morning, man? Hey, that's what I thought. You see, folks, problem with America, sitting right here, all right? I'm messing with you, sort of, all right? But that day, everything went fine. That night before we went to bed, same thing. I'll be a good son for you. Next morning, I'll be a good son for you. Next night, I'll be good. So realize I thought, you know, look, whoa. We got to have a family talk. So I set him down and I said, look, JM, God puts you in our family. You're in our forever family. Forever family. You're going to be part of our family forever. Whether you're good or bad, I realize he was trying to tell me, look, I'm going to be good today. I'm going to be a good son for you, because he wanted to be a part of the family long term. And he never had anything long term. So I had to tell him, you're part of our family, whether you're good or bad. We prefer good, but either way, you're part of our family forever. You know, it took him a few weeks, and he finally quit saying that and adjusted to where he understood the comfort of being a part of a family. And I just want to encourage you, if you ever consider adopting, look, our kids did come very disciplined, but as soon as they just spend a few months with your biological children, they become just as lazy as they are. They really do. They do. It's not a problem, so don't let that bother you, okay? But, you know, I couldn't help but think that night when I went to bed, when he said, I'll be a good son for you, I thought, you know, what would it be like if believers, we said to our Heavenly Father the same thing? That we realize that every day we're to be on mission, living with a purpose, and our reason for breathing and existing today is to please Him. We realize our salvation is not due to works. The Bible makes that very clear. It's by faith, by God's grace, through faith, not of works, lest any man should boast. But James makes it very clear that if you have faith, you're going to actually be kicking it in, and there's going to be some fruit of that relationship. My point is simply this. Every day it should be, God, I'm going to be a good son for you. I'm going to be a good daughter for you. I'm going to be faithful to you. There's an old evangelist, Gypsy Smith, that once was asked, how do you start revival? He said, it's real simple. Oh, it's simple? Oh, it's real simple. He said, you just get a piece of chalk, and you get a piece of chalk, and you go into a room all by yourself. A piece of chalk, and you go into a room all by yourself? Yeah. Get a piece of chalk, you go into a room all by yourself, and then you draw a circle on the floor. And then you get down on your knees in that circle and pray that God would start a revival in that circle. His point was, it starts with you. Today, I just want to encourage you to survey your own heart. Say, God, one, you need to, do you have a relationship with Christ? Do you know for certain you're going to heaven when you die? If you do, man, I'm so grateful. But at the same time, he said, now you're called to make disciples. And so who is your one?